This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Most of us are trying to find more time every day to get things done. So you can't let trips to the post office slow you down. Now you don't have to, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. Sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial, plus $110 in bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. Today's episode is Hypotheticals, part 3 of our post-conviction relief hearing coverage. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs The View from LL2. Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor and blogger at the Evidence Prof blog. We left off last week with the end of Asia McClain's testimony, both direct and cross-examination. After all these years, she finally got to say her piece and set the record straight. So the question now is whether her testimony would have been important more than 16 years ago, whether Gutierrez's failure to call her fell below the standard duty of care for an attorney, and had she contacted her, could it have potentially changed the course of Adnan's trial? In order to figure that out, we need a legal expert.
We left at the end of the last episode having discussed Asia McClain and her testimony as an alibi witness. The next witness we want to discuss is David Irwin, and Irwin is a person who has been on both sides of the bench, serving as both a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and he was called as an expert witness to testify about the standard of effective assistance of counsel and whether Gutierrez lived up to that in this case. And as we'll discuss in a minute, a big part of his testimony was assessing the credibility of Asia as a witness. And you might wonder, before we discussed how Rabia was sequestered under Rule 615 because of the concerns about fact witnesses giving stories that piggybacked off of what the other person said, the difference with an expert witness like Irwin is he is explicitly being called to provide expert testimony based upon hearing what other witnesses had to say. And that's the reason why he was allowed to listen into what Asia had to say in this case. And so, Susan, looking at the notes here, you lead off with, I think, probably the most important thing Irwin had to say. And it's this anecdote about the case that he handled years ago and this whole thing about searching for Asia McClain, right?
Yeah, he gave a story about how, I don't remember the details, but when he was a prosecutor still, there was a case he had, and the defendant in it ended up having an alibi witness of someone he didn't know, but who had seen him on a bus at the time of the crime. And she had reasons for remembering what day the bus ride was, when it was, why she saw him. And he lost, because even though he thought he'd had a strong case, that alibi was so solid and so compelling that the jury found reasonable doubt based on it.
Yeah, and it seems to me, Susan, looking at your notes, that a big part of Justin's strategy in interrogating Irwin was to go through and foreclose any possibility that Gutierrez could have been effective without actually having someone on her team contact Asia McClain. And so, for instance, I can see in the Q&A you have here, could you have avoided a trip to check out an alibi witness by Googling info about the witness? Answer, no, without facts, there can be no strategy. Is there a risk in calling the alibi witness? Absolutely there is, because if they're not credible, you risk losing credibility with the jury. But is it ever justified to not contact an alibi witness? The answer is no. And that's fundamentally what we've expressed on the podcast. It's what case law says. While a person can strategically decide not to call an alibi witness after contacting them, they can't make that decision about calling them as an alibi witness without first contacting them.
As Irwin put it, a credible alibi witness is the best evidence you can produce, short of a video of someone else committing the crime. I mean, Irwin, he is a respected attorney. He's, like Colin said, he has been defense, he's been prosecution, he's well regarded. He knows his stuff. And as he very persuasively testified at the hearing, a credible alibi will make a difference in most cases. And in this case, Asia was both credible and would have made a difference had she testified for the jury at the time of Anand's original trial.
And Susan, that goes to the prejudice prong, which is the second prong of the Strickland test. And then looking further on in your notes, we can see Irwin also testifying about that first prong about unreasonable performance. And basically, it seems as if Justin was trying to get Irwin into the head of Gutierrez, assuming that he was the attorney who back in 1999 received the letters from Asia McLean. He's basically taking him through those letters and asking, for instance, I can see in your notes, what's your impression of Asia letter one? Answer written by a young person that was very intelligent and well-spoken. Question, if there was a confusing nugget somewhere in that letter, would that be reason to dismiss it? Answer, he would be surprised if there's not some wrinkle in the letter, he would promptly follow up. And then speaking to the boyfriend and the friend, Derek and Gerard mentioned in the letter, and his answer in terms of them is he would immediately contact not only Asia McLean, but also these other two individuals. And when Justin asked, that's consistent, you know, contacting these three witnesses with standards of reasonableness, his answer is that's the minimum. So in other words, not great performance, not exemplary performance, but the bare minimum is you get a letter by an alibi witness mentioning two other possible alibi witnesses. At a bare minimum, you contact that witness. And then, of course, a good attorney is going to do more than that in terms of trying to confirm and gather additional evidence for the alibi.
During Asia's cross, Thiru went through and tried to point out why each line of the letter was a reason to doubt it, or a reason to be suspicious, or a reason to think, insert theory of the day here. With Irwin, it was kind of the opposite, in that he went through and pointed out all the reasons why, for a defense attorney, seeing Asia's letters should have made their eyes light up. He pointed out that, for instance, Asia writes that Anand had a calm manner that day, and Irwin said that shows a person who's observant, who's paying attention, who's able to articulate what they saw. That's all a good sign in a witness. She made references to a security system. She made references to third parties that could also verify this information. All of these things, to him, were just key points that if you're looking for an alibi, this is it. It's what you want. The number of times you're going to have an alibi witness with contemporaneous notes reflecting that they're an alibi witness is probably once in a career. And yes, he was a defense witness. He was a defense expert. So it's not a surprise he was testifying favorably for the defense. But he was being very sincere when he said that you are not going to find an Asia McLean every day. If you are lucky, you will get a witness like this a couple times in your career.
And Susan, looking a little further down, question, what is your impression overall of the collection of letters / affidavits? Answer, powerfully credible. And then this also to your point, which I found very interesting, is, as you said, Thiru was trying to poke holes and say maybe there are inconsistencies, et cetera. So Justin basically was, in response to that powerfully credible answer, saying, but you just said there were slight differences between them. How could they be powerfully credible? And the answer by Irwin is, if there weren't some slight changes, I wouldn't think it was true. Too perfect, frailty of human memories over 17 years. And that's just a great answer because it completely subverts and turns on its head through his entire argument, which is to say, yeah, I mean, you're going to expect a high school student who has written various things over 17 years to have these minor inconsistencies. And that certainly does not undermine the credibility of this alibi witness. And in fact, courts have said, we expect degradation of memory over the years. And I think this is really a nice way to show that what's being raised by the prosecution in no way undermines the need to have contacted this witness and the credibility of that witness.
One example they discussed on direct was, say, for instance, you had a defendant, you're a defense attorney, and your defendant is saying that I was in Texas at the time of the crime. And you then find an alibi witness, either through the defendant or some other way, and the alibi says, I saw them somewhere else in Baltimore that day. Is that a reason not to check it out? And the answer is no. Again, clients can be wrong. They often are. So if you're going to buy the theory from the prosecution that Adnan told his attorney something that conflicted with the Asia alibi, that still is not a reason not to contact Asia. Because again, clients can be wrong. Perhaps there's something that can be explained if you talk to this witness. So even giving the prosecution the benefit of every doubt on the factual issues there concerning whether Adnan had given a conflicting factual alibi, it doesn't excuse Gutierrez for failing to check it out.
And I see in your notes, this is interesting because literally today in class, I was discussing alibi notices, and Irwin points out that the alibi notice that Gutierrez had in this case wasn't really an alibi notice because it spoke to his, quote, regular attendance at track practice and sort of his regular practice. It didn't say specifically what he did on January 13th, and therefore, A, as you know, it doesn't matter whether, in fact, he might have given conflicting information about his activities on January 13th, which he didn't. But even if he did, this alibi notice does not tend to establish a contradiction, which is important because very much Judge Welch, in his initial opinion, I think did rely upon the alibi notice. And I think at this point, through the briefing, through the witnesses, it's been shown that that alibi notice isn't worth the paper that it's written on.
One interesting thing that did happen during the direct of Irwin was this issue of whether the information that's relevant before the court is the information available in 1999 or the information that's available now after trial and after 17 years. So one thing that happened was that in answering questions, Irwin would answer twice. He would first answer explaining how he would respond based solely on the information available to Gutierrez in 99. And then he'd answer again based on what he knows now after having looked through the record, after having seen Asia testify in 2016. What I found interesting, though, is that later on during cross and during other times, Thiru kept trying to bring up information that was not available to Gutierrez in 99, like the Juwan notes. And Thiru would try and get Irwin to give an opinion based on the Juwan notes, even though under his own repeated objections, information not available to Gutierrez at the time of trial was not relevant. So he was picking and choosing in terms of information that he felt was and was not relevant.
Right. Yeah. The issue is in terms of Strickland and unreasonable performance for ineffective assistance, it is putting yourself in the shoes of Gutierrez back in 1999 and 2000, and facts or details not known to her clearly could not have impacted her decision and made her decide not to contact Asia McLean. I'll note, Susan, the important thing with Juwan is because I think there's some confusion out there. Juwan actually had two separate interviews. One was turned over actually after the first trial and before the second trial, but that's not the interview where Asia McLean's name came up. That was another interview, and that was never turned over to the defense back in 1999 and 2000, right?
Correct. As a result, then, here was the final verdict from Irwin on Asia. He said that in 1999, on the basis of what Gutierrez had then, she had to go talk to Asia McLean, had to investigate what Asia was saying, and had to investigate the two young men mentioned in Asia's letters. They could have been critical, too. He then continued, based on what we know now, we know Asia is a fabulous witness. She's credible, material, and it would have changed the result. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, and Susan, we can see the last two questions, they are basically prong one and prong two of Strickland's question. Do you have an opinion on Gutierrez's performance? What is it? Answer, her performance was sadly well below the minimum standard required by Strickland. Question, opinion as to materiality of Asia. Answer, my opinion is that she was a game changer. It would have made a huge difference. Its absence takes away any confidence in the verdict. And that's exactly the test. Unreasonable performance and whether it undermines confidence in the verdict, that's prong one and prong two of Strickland. If Judge Welch agrees with Irwin and there was no expert for the prosecution to contradict him, that's enough right there for a claim of ineffective assistance.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, the normal procedure for a hearing is that the defense will have all of its witnesses go first, and then once they finish up, the state will come back and have all of its witnesses, followed by rebuttals. Here, due to unexpected delays and scheduling issues, we ended up having a lot of witnesses called out of order. So even though David Irwin testified initially on Friday, day three, He ended up not having his cross-examination until the following Monday, because the state's phone expert, Chad Fitzgerald, was apparently only able to be in town for that Friday. So in order to accommodate his schedule, they cut off his cross-examination on Friday and put it off for 3 days until the Monday. When his cross did resume, and I think he was the second to last witness at that point that we heard from, Thier started off asking, "Have you seen the documents in the state's organized file?" And Irwin said, "If that was organized, I'd hate to see it unorganized." Which is a good point, because although Thier made complaints about the state of the organization of Gutierrez's file, I'm right there with you, Thier. I mean, her files were that disorganized. That was not, as he tried to imply, some kind of trick by the defense. It's just that her files were not well kept, and that's a fact of this case, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've commented before in my blog about how there are files from other cases in Adnan's files, and the scary thing is it makes you wonder, if we were to get the case file for some other client, would there be files from this case that were misplaced, which could have had great relevance to the defense here?
Anyway, due to the weekend, Irwin had gotten a chance to read through the entirety of the defense file. And the reason he did that and did it carefully was because Thier had tried to score points earlier, as we'll get to, with another witness, the defense investigator for Anand's defense. And during his cross-examination, Thier had repeatedly made reference to the fact that the defense investigator had not read the entire defense file and tried to use this as proof that somehow the defense was hiding something or that the defense investigator couldn't have an opinion on what had actually happened. So I guess Irwin saw that, and he was not going to let Thier try and make a baseless point like that against him. So he studied up and came in on Monday and had read every document that Thier wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and in addition, Susan, I can see after we get through the files and the organization, I can see that Thier was asking Irwin whether he's familiar with a particular Supreme Court case which says you have to put yourself in the position of the attorney before speculating whether counsel should have done things differently. And that's, I mean, I was assuming it's the Supreme Court, the key case in Strickland versus Washington. I'm quoting from that, where basically they say that counsel's investigatory decisions must be assessed in light of the information known at the time of the decisions, not in hindsight. And it's interesting because that's correct. And I can see Thier was using it very much to say, we can't rely upon what happened to Gutierrez with her disbarment after the fact. But the interesting thing is, that's exactly the same reasoning used by the Fourth Circuit in Griffin to say, we shouldn't hypothesize potential strategic reasons why an attorney failed to contact an alibi witness, which is exactly what Thier was trying to do. And really the only way he would be able to practically establish that there was a reason to fail to contact an alibi witness. And Griffin says you can't do that. Griffin says there's a duty to contact and you can't write off that duty based upon concerns you have about an alibi witness. Yeah, but then, Susan, as we move along, it seems that the interrogation very much shifted from the defense file and what was actually there to a series of hypotheticals. And I see hypotheticals about an alibi witness being on the space station, someone claiming to be the Pope or the president. And that, you know, you in the courtroom probably have a better perspective there. But it seems like Thier was advancing a series of increasingly ridiculous hypotheticals to try to come up with some scenario where defense counsel be relieved of the duty to contact an alibi witness.
The hypotheticals were definitely on the extreme edge of the hypo scale. And even then, Irwin would usually answer in a way that Thier wasn't very pleased with, because, for instance, with the space station example, Thier asked, well, if that witness had been on the space station at the time your client is telling you that this alibi witness saw them somewhere other than the crime, would you have to investigate? And Irwin said, well, I wouldn't necessarily need to interview them if they're on the space station, but I'd need to confirm they were on the space station. So yeah, if I did confirm for a fact this person was in space at the time they were supposedly being an alibi, then I wouldn't necessarily need to interview that person. But that still doesn't help what point Thier was trying to make, because he was still clear. You still investigate it. There are circumstances in which interviewing the alibi witness may not be required, but in every case, an investigation of some sort will still be required.
And Susan, you already went through the hypothetical about the Gospe witness, and Irwin explained why he would still contact that witness. there's a question here by Thiru about, well, what if you are fearful the witness is possibly harmful to your case? And of course, Irwin's response is, they could very well become a witness for the prosecution. I have every incentive to speak to that witness before they speak to the state. And that seemed to be the tenor and the substance of this whole series of questions, was Thiru asking a bunch of hypotheticals and Irwin standing firm and saying, yeah, look, in any scenario, you're going to reach out and contact. Now, there are plenty of scenarios where you're going to decide, I'm not going to call the witness, but there's simply not a realistic, plausible scenario where you can reasonably decide, I'm not going to simply reach out and contact this prospective alibi witness.
And even in the space shuttle scenario, you would still, as I believe Irwin put it, if you did find they were on the space station, that would trigger a memo to the file. So that would be recorded somewhere by the attorney. In this case, Gutierrez didn't do any of that. She just didn't follow up with this whole alibi issue. There was never any attempt to verify any part of it.
And here's a part I find interesting, because this is one of our theories we've had before, and Thiru is actually maybe unintentionally eliciting it during cross-examination, where he asks, question, with the exception of those two letters and a note by the law clerk, are there any other references to Asia McLean? And Earn's response is, I don't think so. Maybe another Asia, but not Asia McLean. Ostensibly, Irwin is referring to what we noted before, the several references to Hayes' best friend, Aisha, where the name is written as Asia, which again, if we're going back to Judge Welch's primary question, why was Asia not contacted? Well, that Q&A right there kind of answers it, possibly, where Gutierrez very well could have been confused between Aisha and Asia and thought she had made contact with this witness.
And in addition to the Asia example in particular, Thiru also tried to explore other reasons that may have justified Gutierrez's failure to look into the alibi or investigate more thoroughly in general. To me, what I thought Thiru was trying to do, based on his questions about money, is he was trying to imply that perhaps Adnan had stopped paying Gutierrez and that would justify her failure to investigate. It was a little bit hard to follow, but he kept asking, so what happens if your client's not paying? Are you going to put as much effort into the case? Well, the fact the client isn't paying is not at all a justification for failure to investigate. I mean, that's how it works. If you're an attorney for a criminal defendant and they stop paying, you can't just walk away. You can't just do a half-assed job. That's not permitted. I can't imagine the theory without that Irwin would say otherwise, too. So I'm not even totally sure if that's what he was trying to get at. But he also started getting at the fact that, oh, so Gutierrez had other cases, right? Yes. Now, how many cases did you have in comparison to a typical public defender? And I think Thiru was trying to point out that a public defender's caseload is usually pretty heavy, and it usually is. It's usually far busier than it should be. But if he was trying to make the point that Gutierrez's performance was no worse than public defender's because she had lots of cases on her plate and a PD would have lots of cases on their plate, that doesn't work either. Because as Irwin pointed out, even for public defenders, if you have a death penalty case, that will often be the only case that public defender will work on. And plus, factually, none of this is supported because Gutierrez was paid and paid a lot. That was probably the primary point of concern in all of Gutierrez's notes. That's the thing she focuses on all the time. That's most of what her self-assigned tasks involved. And the caseload she had was, it doesn't make sense for anyone. It doesn't matter, public defender, private attorney. Her caseload was unmanageable. It was too heavy for what she was capable of. I don't know if anyone would be capable of handling that many murder cases in that many jurisdictions at one time.
Yeah, and we know that in this case, she couldn't. She failed to file the brief in the Whitman case. She failed to file the brief in the Acosta Martinez case. That's the case that established that the death penalty applies in Puerto Rico. In addition to that, the Wiatrowski PCR, the appeal, that was contemporaneous, and she failed to file the PCR petition in that case. So she certainly, whatever anyone might have been able to do, was not in her current physical and mental condition able to handle things. And yeah, in this case, certainly I don't see how Thiru made much headway in terms of his cross-examination. Yeah, and then Susan, it seems to me that the next tact that Thiru took was to try to show that Gutierrez's theory of the case was to raise doubt about time of death, maybe then downplaying the importance of Asia McLean. But that didn't seem to make much headway either, because if you have an ambiguous time of death, that makes it all the more important that you establish an alibi defense, which is then the next topic where basically, it seemed Theo was trying to say, well, here's the alibi notice, here are the alibi witnesses in the case. And Irwin is basically saying, yeah, but these people weren't actual alibis. Coach Tsai was not at trial able to testify that Adnan was at practice on January 13th. And many of these other alibi witnesses were never contacted or didn't cover the actual time frame of the murder. Again, isolating how important Asia McClain was and how using her, at least just contacting her, certainly couldn't have contradicted any possible alibi defense that Adnan presented at trial.
Worth noting that this was one of the more exciting or more lively parts of the hearing. Although the subject matter is kind of dry, it's the standard of care for attorneys in contacting alibi witnesses. The exchange between Theo and Irwin was very testy, very snipey, I think would be a fair way to describe it. And Irwin was definitely in control of the exchange. He would not take Theo's bait. Theo kept trying to set up, you know, traditional cross-examination style, trying to lay traps, basically, or trying to lead the way for Irwin to give answers that would help the state. And Irwin was having none of it. He would simply reject Theo's premises and say, I know what you're trying to do. I'm not going to do it. So move on.
Yes, there's two more things I think we want to address with the cross-examination. The first is a factual inaccuracy. Here's a question from Theo. Yurik first announced the state's time of death theory in his opening statement to the second trial. Did you review the transcript? And Irwin's response is not the full transcript. No. As we've reported before, I've written about it in my blog, that is an incorrect characterization because we know at the first trial, an opening statement, I'm reading from it, well, after the day went by in the afternoon, about 2:30, 2:40, he gets a page and he's got the defendant's car. He's got the defendant's cell phone. He gets a page to meet defendant at the Best Buy. So in the opening statement at the very first trial back in 1999, this 2:36 timeline was part of the state's case. And so that's a factual inaccuracy. And then Susan, sort of summing up, this is toward the end of the cross-examination where I think Irwin really nails the defense point and repudiates what's being claimed by the state. And basically the question here is, Theo is trying to say Gutierrez had her preferred alibi and Asia could have disrupted that, which really isn't true because her timeline doesn't contradict the timeline of any other potential alibi witness. But here's Irwin's response. I'm not picking Asia McClain over anyone. Under the rules as I know them, it was mandated for the defense team to go out and talk to them. I'm talking about a credible, unbiased alibi. I'm saying it was mandated duty to investigate Asia McClain. You keep talking strategy. You're begging the world to believe that Christina Gutierrez had a strategy, but there was no strategy. You can't have a strategy without information. A strategy is a course of action. You're saying that I think my strategy would be better. I'm saying there was no strategy. And that is Griffin. That is the case that originated from the same course. That is exactly what the Fourth Circuit found. There can be no strategy without investigation and contacting an alibi witness. And I think that pretty much wraps up the cross-examination.
To counter that, Theo did try to bring up that, oh, Gutierrez did have an alibi strategy. She did investigate things. She did plan things. And at one point, he put a memo on the screen to show Irwin. We've discussed it on a previous episode of Undisclosed. And it's a to-do list, which has make determination regarding alibi. And next to it, it says urgent and underline exclamation point. And Theo asked Irwin, is it fair to say that Gutierrez and her team were thinking about an alibi from the very beginning? And Irwin's response was good. It was, well, she didn't have an alibi at all. He started asking questions back, actually, saying, did she? Who was this alibi? Who'd she call? She didn't have one. But even that memo that Theo was referring to, it was written at the very earliest on September 24th, and more likely done early October-ish. So 2 to 3 weeks before trial is the first time that Theo could find evidence from the defense file that an alibi witness had even been considered. And that was the basis of his question, is it fair to say that Gutierrez was thinking about an alibi from the very beginning? On redirect, again, Justin Brown came back and just tried to clear up a few of the misinformation questions that had been thrown out there, such as explaining Anand's routine and how he didn't just have a single routine every day like Theo was actually stating. And he asked, based on all the hypotheticals that you just heard from Thiru, would you worry about calling Asia McClain, assuming all those hypotheticals had been true? And he said, sure, I'd be worried about calling anyone, but I'd have a duty to investigate to see if they'd help or hurt. But with what I know now, I would not be worried about Asia McClain. One other point of note is that Erwin, too, had known Gutierrez. Back in the day, he had worked with, worked against, and known Gutierrez, and he said that in her day, she was excellent. In her prime, she was. But he, too, had seen her decline, and he, too, was able to testify to the fact, not just as an expert, but as someone, as a fact witness who had seen it, that no, she was not the same woman she had been. The defense also called its investigator, Sean Gordon, to testify to what he had found in the course of investigating the alibi notice and some of the alibi witnesses, or semi-alibi, I don't even know what you'd call them. When he did investigate the pseudo-alibi stuff that Gutierrez did look into, his usual routine was to do XYZ kind of thing. As mentioned earlier, Gordon contacted the 83 people on the alibi notice to find out if Gutierrez had ever contacted them, and in particular, contacted them to be an alibi witness. And it turned out, of the 83, she'd only ever contacted or communicated directly or indirectly with four of them, and none of them had been contacted to be an alibi witness, as far as they knew. He also investigated Gutierrez's attempt to put together some kind of semi-pseudo-alibi for the track team.
Yeah, this is something that I have written about in my blog before. Obviously, a big part of Adnan's potential alibi was his attendance at track practice and specifically arriving on time at track practice. And basically what we had here in the defense files was this memo that contained the names of eight members of the track team. And it turned out, as Justin drew out during direct examination, was that this was a list that Gutierrez's law clerk slash law student had gotten by looking at a single page in the yearbook, finding basically the top eight track athletes who were listed in the yearbook, and then taking those names, putting them into a memo, missing out on, you know, 30 something members of the boys' indoor track team. And then of the people on that memo, we had a couple different failures in terms of trying to contact those witnesses. So one was track teammate Will, who appears in Jay's ride-along notes, who the student failed to realize had graduated from Woodlawn and was a senior in 99, meaning that his subpoena never reached him. And then Susan, I know from what you're reporting, there was a second track teammate who did get a subpoena, but there were issues with him, right?
Well, he was subpoenaed and he went to the court because that's what he had to do. And no one ever talked to him or called him or asked him to testify. So he had no idea what was going on with that. And in fact, I guess he was could have kind of been an alibi, or he was on the track team, but no one ever asked him if he saw it on that day. So I'm not sure why Gutierrez went ahead and subpoenaed him.
It's not a direct answer to Judge Welch's question, but I think there's an accumulation of circumstantial evidence here. You see all these people on the alibi notice, people at the mosque, people on the track team, and you just see a shoddy effort to try to contact people. And again, going back to the question of why didn't Gutierrez contact Asia McClain, I think you can look at all these different people who were never contacted or never asked about an alibi defense, and it becomes fairly easy to speculate that, just as with these witnesses, there was some type of negligence or really recklessness going on at Gutierrez's law firm in 99 that, for any number of reasons, simply led to Asia being lost and her contact information being there in the defense files, but no one actually reaching out and seeking to make contact.
At one point, Thiru tried to say that, oh, Gutierrez did a great job. She talked to people that you're not mentioning now. So he asked Gordon, would it surprise you to learn that there was contact between Gutierrez and Saad before the first trial? And Gordon responded, well, usually you're supposed to talk to witnesses before they testify, so no.
Plus, she represented Saad, right?
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of tough for her not to have contact with him when she represented him before she started representing Adnan in the case.
I think the examples that Thier was forced to use to try and say that Gutierrez did do a diligent and great job are themselves fantastic evidence for the defense about how little she did. If the fact that Gutierrez talked to a witness before she put him on the stand is evidence of how good Gutierrez did, well, that bar is really low.
Yeah, and again, it's important to note that Adnan's claim is single issue ineffective assistance, the cell tower issue, which we'll get to, and then failure to contact Asia McClain. It's not ineffective assistance in the aggregate. And again, all this is important circumstantial evidence, but the fact that she talked to other witnesses, even if that were some evidence of competence, doesn't excuse the failure to talk to Asia McClain. Yeah, and so then Thier tried to go through and basically cast aspersions at the defense for not contacting some of the clerks who worked for Gutierrez back in 1999, such as Mike Lewis and Callie, another person who actually now works for the state of Maryland, and was basically trying to imply that they very well could have had information that contradicted the defense narrative. But you know, the point is, the prosecution very well could have called these witnesses themselves. And in fact, the defense did submit an affidavit from the clerk who on July 13th took the notes about Asia McClain. And basically that clerk, while he was able to authenticate the notes as written by him and said he would give them over to Gutierrez, he said he had no specific recollection of Asia McClain or what happened with her. We have Asia saying she was never contacted. And, you know, in the absence of evidence that there was a strategic reason to fail to contact her, and in the absence of legal precedent saying there could be a reason not to contact her, that's something that the defense didn't have to prove. And if the prosecution wanted to contradict that, it was incumbent upon them to produce that evidence.
Or it could just make it up like it did. For instance, this one was driving me crazy in the court because I was pretty sure that no one else in the room other than the defense team would see what he was doing because of the way he presented it. But what Thier did is he put on his little projector a memo from the defense that says, oh, here are the 8 track team names listed in the yearbook. We should contact them and subpoena them to have a pseudo alibi about how Anon usually went to track. And he says to Gordon, do you see where it says that this track team member was contacted? And then there's a notation that says 20 minutes late. And there's kind of like a, not a gasp, because no one's gasping in the courtroom, but there was kind of like, oh, it turns out that Anon was late to track, or some kind of dramatic point that he just like scored a huge victory. And it doesn't say that at all. There is a little handwritten memo that says 20 minutes late, but it's cut off, so you can't read the rest of it. So without time to go through the documents and look at them, if you're sitting there in the courtroom, it did seem very much as if Thier had just proven that the track team was contacted and the track team had informed Gutierrez that Anon was 20 minutes late to practice and therefore he's guilty and we should all go home now. It doesn't say that at all. If you read the actual notes, it says, and we'll call him Kehinde, it's the track team member that this refers to, it says, left message on answering machine. Then 20 minutes later, dad returned my call and said son was away at college. That was Thier's proof that the track team had told Gutierrez that Anon was 20 minutes late for practice. I don't know if he willfully misinterpreted this, if he knew what he was doing, or if he was just so eager to find something that his brain actually read this the way he presented it. But it doesn't make any sense because that track team member, Kehinde, is the same one that was subpoenaed and shut up at court being like, what am I doing here? And no one ever talked to him. So we already know no one ever talked to him about this. He never told anyone anything about whether Anon was there or not. So how could there possibly have been a notation that says he told the defense that Anon was 20 minutes late when even Thier has acknowledged and is questioning that this one was never actually contacted? I don't know. Colin, what do you think about that?
You were able to find this in the defense files. I hadn't seen this version of the track memo because there is a file there that deals with the track team. And this document is entirely elsewhere in the files. I mean, it's entirely possible that the reason why someone like this teammate was never talked to despite getting the subpoena is that these were all different places in the defense files. And when they looked at the track file, they didn't realize the contact had been made at least with the father. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, certainly it doesn't support the notion that Anand was 20 minutes late to track practice. If anything, I think it shows the disorganized nature of the files and the possibility that the track alibi basically fell through the cracks as Gutierrez didn't realize that this document existed.
That poor kid must have been so confused. I just imagine him sitting in the hallway at the courthouse because he's been subpoenaed and legally required to be there and has no idea why. And what, is she going to put on the stand? She's never talked to him, so why would you ever call them in the first place, let alone subpoena them? Anyway, the rest of the cross-examination of Gordon was much the same. For instance, he put on the screen a memo from the defense that discusses what Coach Russell said about how he didn't keep a roster of track attendance. And according to Theroux, isn't this evidence that the defense team was considering the track alibi and was doubting it? Well, no, it's not, because that memo isn't a memo like he was portraying it. It was not a memo of the defense talking to a track coach. It was, in fact, a word-for-word copying of the Baltimore County investigator's interview of the track coach. One of the clerks had taken what the state produced to them and had literally copied and pasted that text and put it in a defense memo and formatted it that way. And to Theroux, this was evidence that the defense was skeptical of Anand's claims of being a track. And that brings us to the library witnesses. The first one was Michelle Hamill, who y'all have heard from before in Serial, episode 1, I believe. She was the employee at the Woodlawn Public Library that Sarah Koenig spoke to.
Yeah, and basically the primary purpose in calling her is to establish that Woodlawn Public Library had a video surveillance system back in 1999. And Hamill knew this because she's the one who changed out the tapes. She also knew that they definitely had video surveillance back in early 1999 because she testified that she left Woodlawn in mid-1999 to get a master's degree. So based upon that, she was very clearly able to say there was video surveillance. She also testified that in the hour after school ended, it was chaotic at the library, lots of students coming in, lots of students going out. Wasn't enough room for all the students in the library. And so very easy to imagine someone entering or exiting the library without someone noticing their presence.
Yeah, I mean, the direct was really simple. Basically, she worked there. She knew based on the dates that she had been at the public library in Woodlawn in January of 99. Yes, she was working there. And yes, she knows specifically during that time period, there were cameras. On cross, Theroux kept trying to say there weren't. So during Asia's cross-examination, Theroux tried to, well, not even tried, he did say, would it surprise you to learn that there were no cameras in the library when you said there were? And he tried to use this as evidence that she was lying or mistaken or confused or a bad witness because Asia said that she'd called the library and the library had told her there were cameras. So if there weren't cameras, well, draw your own conclusions. And the way Theroux had presented this, it was as if he knew for a fact there were no cameras in the library, which is why last minute, the defense brought in Hamill to say, well, no, there were definitely cameras. I changed them out. That's why I know. Here's what I think happened. I think Theroux had an article or something, I think, that said in like February of 2002 or later on, the Woodlawn Public Library got cameras. But it was talking about outdoor surveillance cameras, not the indoor ones. I think he had mistaken the fact that new outdoor surveillance cameras were installed as evidence that there hadn't been indoor cameras previously, when there definitely had been. Oh, and then he also tried to like take her statements in Serial out of context by saying, when you were asked if there were cameras, you told that reporter, probably yes, I'm going to say yes. And Hamill very confidently said, well, the question I was answering was, could we have checked the cameras? That was her question. The tapes were only kept 30 days. So whether or not we could check them depends if they were asked in time. But I wasn't saying that there were probably cameras because there were cameras there.
Yeah. And then, Susan, I guess the last relevant thing that comes up during cross-examination is that Theroux is laying the foundation for a subsequent witness, Steve, the security guard at the public library. And basically he starts asking about this individual who was a security guard and asking about who he was and what function he served. And that sort of unintentionally on Theria's behalf, prompts the response that this guy, Steve, the security guard, was, according to your notes, kind of a goofy guy, would usually get along with the kids. At the library, he was pretty much useless. I did more security work than they did. And that then prompted a whole Twitter meme and people talking about this witness, the sort of like the hashtag useless Steve. And that eventually sets the stage for the security guard, Steve, testifying as one of the two state's witnesses at the hearing.
You know, at this point, I had heard that the surprise witness that was mentioned on day one, I knew that supposedly the prosecution had an affidavit from a security guard who was able to swear to the fact that he remembered January 13th, 1999, and knew for a fact that Anand had not been there. And I thought it was a joke, to be honest, because it didn't occur to me that the prosecution would actually try and introduce testimony of that nature. So I was pretty shocked when, in fact, it turned out the state did want to bring a witness like that to the stand. In total, they had two witnesses. One was Chad Fitzgerald, the FBI agent who testified to the cell phone issues. The other one was security guard Steve. When I'd heard security guard Steve had written an affidavit or something saying that he remembered the state clearly, I did not think it was someone being truthful or being honest, because I couldn't imagine a scenario in which someone would claim to have that kind of memory. But as it turned out, what security guard Steve remembered and what he was actually testifying to was something very different from what the state was presenting it as.
Yeah, so basically the way that the state found Steve was that 2 days after Adnan was arrested, the private investigator, Drew Davis, had gone to Woodlawn, and his billing invoice indicates that he spoke to Coach Michael Sy, the track coach at Woodlawn, and then that he spoke to Wackenhut officer Mills, which is this individual, Steve Mills, which, you know, as Susan, I think, looked in response to a comment in my blog and looked up Wackenhut, and I think saw it was a security firm that did, among other things, food service at the prison. So I had no idea that this was someone at the library, but yeah, and the prosecution was able to find this individual and realize, oh, he worked at the library. And so, look, this means that the defense was investigating the library alibi. I've been trying to think through since the hearing what exactly the state was trying to establish, because on the one hand, they're trying to claim Adnan initially did not claim an alibi defense of the library, and it was created later, and these Asia letters are backdated. But yet, on the other hand, they have this letter showing the library was being investigated on March 3rd, and it just, I mean, do you have a sense from being there of what Theria was trying to argue?
All of the above.
Right, sort of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Not even that. He just was trying to make things look dark and scary and nefarious all the time. He never even tried to hang it all together. He never even tried to put a theory together to throw at the wall in the first place. It was just raising questions and trying to get people to draw their own conclusions based on an assumption that Theria's questions actually had a factual basis, which they usually didn't. So to back up for a bit, the way the evidence was introduced at the hearing was interesting. Prior to the court's order and their agreement, the defense had produced to the state a list of documents it intended to present as exhibits at trial. The state never produced any such list, and the defense assumed it's because they had no exhibits, or it knew that it had exhibits, but I mean, technically, that's what the state was saying. Oh, we're not going to give you a list of exhibits because we have none. What they actually did was a sort of sneaky backdoor trick where they prepared two binders. Binder A was full of a selection of defense documents, and binder B was a selection of the state's documents. And it said, rather than give you a list of exhibits, we're just going to admit these two binders of hundreds of pages of documents each, and we'll bring up the ones that are relevant as we go along. The judge allowed this, and the binders were admitted wholesale into evidence. The effect of this was that the defense had no way of knowing what documents are going to be raised. And for instance, with the 20-minute thing, the 20-minute memo, I don't care how prepared Justin was, and he was prepared, there is no way he was ever going to be able to guess that Theria would try and claim that this stupid memo says that someone on the track team told Gutierrez that Anand was 20 minutes late. That was just not going to ever reach his to-do list for this hearing. So by having exhibits admitted in this binder format, Justin couldn't examine them in advance, and he had no way to instantly respond, well, everything you just said is plainly and blatantly false. So that's why the state did it that way. The effect of it, though, and what Justin kept objecting to, is that this gave a very misleading appearance of what's actually going on. Because, well, take Binder A, the defense files. What Theroux did was organize the files, make them look like they had a pattern, and make them look like they had more order than they do in reality by putting certain documents in certain arrangements to try and suggest some kind of order that was never actually there. It's just his selection of pages that make it kind of look like that. And it also left out pages. So the defense, it lost the motion to have these binders excluded and only to have pages admitted into evidence. And finally, Justin said, okay, but if you're going to do this, you have to have the entire defense file come in. You cannot have the state's selected version of the defense file in the record. So luckily, the entire defense file got in and not just the state's preferred version of it. I will say, because the defense file went to Sarah Koenig for serial, and it's been shared since then in our blogs on Undisclosed, attorney-client privilege didn't exist for it anymore. And as a result, the state was entitled to have it. I knew how disappointed the state was going to be when they saw that file, because I knew the state was really eager to find out what was in it and what kind of things Justin was trying to hide. But the truth of the matter is, there's nothing in there that helps the state. There's no kind of magic helping document in there that shows that Gutierrez did things well, because she didn't do things well. And there's no evidence showing Anand's guilty in there, because no, he didn't secretly confess to his attorneys. So if I had to guess, the state was probably pretty disappointed when it finally got the defense file and saw, oh, great. All we've got is this memo saying that they tried to call this random person and his dad called back 20 minutes later. That's all we got.
Yeah, and I think, as far as I can tell from down here, that the state realized that, because everything you just described, there's a rule of evidence. It's Federal Rule 1006. Maryland would be Rule 5-1006. And it says the proponent may use a summary chart or calculation to prove the contents of voluminous writings, recordings, or photographs that cannot be conveniently examined in court. And then there's an advisory committee note. That's the committee that basically addresses the passage of such rules. And it says, the admission of summaries of voluminous books, records, or documents offers the only practical means of making their contents available to judge and jury. Yeah, I mean, what Theroux basically, I think, tried to do, as far as I can tell from down here, is basically to have these huge binders, and he couldn't find anything. And so by introducing them in their totality, he is basically asking Judge Welch to, hopefully in a fishing expedition, find something himself, because the examples that we've gone over and I've heard about in social media where he's trying to claim 20 minutes late or the Joanne note or things of that nature, when you actually look at the documents, you see they don't add up to what Theroux is trying to claim they add up to.
And the Joanne note is a good example of this, because if the prosecution had simply admitted its chosen binders only, and if Justin had insisted that the entire defense file come into the record, what the court couldn't have seen is that the Juwan notes were nowhere to be had in the defense file. That entire set of records, the entire 127-page of witness notes that came from, that's not in the defense file. And if you have a partial selected copy of the defense file, you might assume that, oh, those documents were available to Gutierrez, they're just not in this binder. This way the court can see now, no, the Juwan notes, Gutierrez never had them.
Yeah, I mean, really, the only concern I have about these huge binders coming into evidence is that it might delay Judge Welch's ruling. But yeah, exactly as you said, Susan, when Judge Welch or his clerk most likely sits down and sifts through this entire defense file, they're not going to find anything that rebuts the claim of ineffective assistance levied against Gutierrez in this case.
So given the paucity of documents that support the state's case here, they ended up focusing on this invoice that Colin mentioned. And that's how they found, about 5 days before the hearing started, security guard Steve. The first time they talked to him, it was Theroux and a Detective Vini, I believe, who was not previously involved in this case. And they go and talk to him, and he says, I was a security guard, no surveillance inside library, here are the hours I worked at the library, that's it. And then he signs his name at the bottom of the police notes. Nothing too exciting. Then on February 3rd, the first day of the hearing, they talk to security guard Steve again. And this time, the police notes of this interview say, "I looked at photographs from Woodlawn High School yearbook for years 99 and 98. Could not recognize whether or not anyone featured in the yearbook came into library on January 13, 1999. After Lee's body was found and the news of Anand Syed being charged for her murder, he remembers Syed's picture being on the news. When he saw Syed's picture, he can say for certain that he was not in the library the day of Wednesday, January 13, 1999. If Syed wasn't in the library, Mills states that he would have brought it to the attention of the police. And then it says, I have reviewed these notes and they accurately document the statements I made to Detective Vini, security guard Steve signed. Now, as we mentioned during the PCR live updates, I think the single most important exchange that happened during security guard Steve's testimony at the hearing was this. Question from Thiru. At some point, you saw a picture of the person charged with the murder on TV. Did you recall that person? Answer, no. I could have, but I couldn't recall. Question, if you had recognized him, what would you have done? Answer, I would have called 911. Here's what seems to have happened. Security guard Steve believed, not unreasonably, that he was being asked to say whether an accused murderer had been in the library on a day when he was working as a security guard. And security guard Steve seemed to have assumed that the detectives were asking about this because if he'd seen the murderer's picture on TV, he presumably would have known if the murderer was there in the library. And therefore, since security guard Steve does not recall seeing a murderer in the library, he can say Anand wasn't there. What the detectives were actually asking him was, in fact, do you recall a random, uneventful day in January 99 when you were working at the library as a security guard? And do you recall if this random student in particular was or was not there? Well, of course he doesn't. No one recalls that. That's not a memory anyone on Earth would ever have, which is why I think security guard Steve answered the way he did. And at first, when I first heard about what he would say, I assumed it would be some kind of exaggerated or dishonest testimony because, again, no one could have remembered that. But in fact, security guard Steve was answering the only question that he reasonably could have expected the detectives to be asking him.
Right. And Steve also answered that he didn't recall speaking to the defense private investigator back in 1999, which makes me think that that March 3rd conversation that he presumably had with Davis was about, I'm assuming, pretty basic stuff. You know, what are the rules of the library? What do students generally do, et cetera, as opposed to sort of a pointed investigation into any type of alibi with Asia McClain. So who knows? But that's the point, is who knows? There's no recollection of Steve about what the conversation was. There are no notes by the PI. So don't know exactly what was going on, but it seems like it wasn't anything especially important.
And this is the best evidence the state could come up with to refute Anand's claims that he is entitled to a new trial based on ineffective assistance of counsel. The fact that they were willing to try and get this man to go on the stand, I think, you know, Colin, what do you think? Do you think the detectives had to have known what security guard Steve was actually trying to say?
I sort of go back and forth because on the one hand, there were so many factual inaccuracies presented this hearing that I just feel the state, this new team that came in, lacked a basic grasp of what the actual facts of the case were. So I could easily write it off as them being completely confused as to what the actual facts were and that confusion being relayed. Or as you sort of indicate, it might be something a little bit more nefarious, but I just look at the case and what was presented and think there was not a strong grasp of the factual record here.
To me, the only reason they would present him is if they thought he was helping their case. And based on what he was saying, it's only if they thought he actually could recall January 13th and could recall whether this picture of the student matched anyone there in the room that day. And frankly, I do not believe that the detectives didn't realize the misunderstanding that Steve had. And maybe I'm being too harsh, but they didn't realize what they were doing. Either way, presenting testimony that is that absurd as saying whether or not someone recalls a face from a day at work 17 years ago, I guess when you don't have much to go on, you're any port in a storm? I don't know. It does underline for me just how weak the state's case was and how little they had to grasp that. The state actually brought security guard Steve in to support two points it was trying to make at the PCR hearing. The first one, which we just discussed, was that security guard Steve had been at the library on January 13th, 1999, and could not remember seeing Anand there.
This testimony, or this hoped for testimony, did not come up in the first interview that security guard Steve gave. Instead, it came up during a second interview on February 3rd, the same day the PCR hearing started, in which he talked only to two detectives. Presumably, there was no prosecutor there because the prosecutor was in court with all of us. And in that interview, security guard Steve told the detectives, if Syed was in the library, security guard Steve states he would have brought it to the attention of the police. As we know now, what security guard Steve meant was that he would have called 911 because he thought he'd seen a murderer. But it looks like Thiru, when he read this, read the statement to be something else entirely. He thought that the security guard had told the detectives that if he had seen Anand in the library, he would now, at this time in 2016, bring it to the detective's attention. Instead, what he meant was, in fact, that no, he would have called them in 99 because he'd seen a murderer. The other point that security guard Steve was brought in to talk about was the security cameras. In his very first interview for the hearing, which was January 31st, in which both Detective Vini and Thiru were present, he said that there were no cameras in the library. Pretty straightforward. His words were, in 1999, I was working at Woodlawn Library as a security guard. The library was not under video surveillance, not equipped. No surveillance equipment inside library. I left the library in 2001. At the hearing, security guard Steve did say this. That's something like what he said. But when Thiru asked him, is it possible there were cameras there? And I don't know why on direct Thiru even tried to do this. He probably just assumed that security guard Steve had a better answer than he did. But Steve answered, well, it's possible, very possible. As in, he didn't know of any cameras in the library in 99, but I mean, he wouldn't have known about them. So, you know, sure, it's possible there were. He just didn't know about any. So in the end, security guard Steve was useless for the state because he didn't prove a single point they brought him in to prove.
Yeah, so Susan, if we sort of wrap everything up at the end and put ourselves into Judge Welch's shoes, basically he needs to answer three questions in the affirmative to give Adnan a new trial based upon this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. The first question is, did Gutierrez and her team fail to contact Asia McLean? Second, if they failed to contact her, was that failure to contact her unreasonable? And then third, if that failure was unreasonable, was there prejudice? In other words, is there a reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial if she had been contacted? That's not a preponderance of the evidence test. The defense does not need to establish it's more likely than not that Asia would have changed the outcome at trial. All they need to establish is that the failure to contact Asia undermines our confidence in the jury's verdict. Looking at question one, Asia confidently and consistently has said all the way back from 2000 to 2016, she was never contacted by the defense. Ken Wisher's testimony about the alibi notice corroborates that if she's not in the alibi notice, she wasn't contacted. No evidence whatsoever she was contacted. It's tough to see anything other than the first question being answered in the affirmative. The second question, there was testimony by Ken Wisher. There was testimony by Irwin. There is precedent from Maryland, the Paris W case. There's precedent from the Fourth Circuit, the Griffin case. There's precedent from across the country that there can't be a strategic reason to fail to contact an alibi witness. Basically, Welch would have to come up with basically a new legal argument to go against on-point precedent from the jurisdiction across the country. I don't see that happening. So that leaves prejudice. That leaves the third prong. We know that Irwin said she was a game changer. We know that there's Maryland precedent saying, based upon Kyles versus Whitley, the Supreme Court case, that closing arguments are the best evidence of prejudice. We know the state claimed in closing that Adnan had killed Hay by 2:36 p.m. in the Best Buy a mile from the high school. And we know that Asia has confidently and consistently said she saw Adnan in the library until 2:40 p.m. Based upon that, it seems to me, again, from my distance in South Carolina, that there was a strong showing of all three elements by the defense. Prosecution basically tried to do everything it could to hypothesize why there were strategic reasons to fail to contact Asia McLean. As far as I can tell, Susan, they didn't cite any case law, any precedent, whereas Justin cited to 9 specific cases and then 70 more general cases from across the country. In terms of prejudice, I know they tried to claim in closing that the state could have shifted the timeline to the 3:15 call being the Best Buy call, and that that could have made Asia either irrelevant or even potentially harmful. But what we know is those two cases I cited before, the Paris W case, that was a case with an uncertain timeline, and the Court of Appeals of Maryland found that helped the defense. We also know in the Griffin case, that was a case, as I mentioned last episode, where the state claimed we could have shifted the timeline, and very similar to this case, under that timeline and the alibi witness being 3 miles from the site of the Rite Aid robbery, that could have hurt the defense case. And the Fourth Circuit rejected that very easily and said, no, as long as the alibi witness refutes some timeline the state could have and in fact did present at trial, that's enough for prejudice. So my conclusion, again, from my reading of your notes in this case, looking at social media, I think that the defense made a strong showing of all three of those points that I raised.
The defense did what it needed to do. And that's, I mean, that's all you can control. It put its evidence on, it made a strong case for each point, and then, well, the state didn't have much to come back with. So it refuted what it could. There wasn't much there to refute in the first place. And yeah, that's all you can do. At the end of the day, they did their job, and now it's a waiting game. But here's the upside. Because the record was so strong, and because the defense came in so prepared, they are well positioned for appeal. No matter how the judge rules, they are going to have a very strong record to draw from during the inevitable appeals process.
There's one last thing I'd like to add to this episode, and it's a discussion of the motion to supplement filed by Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, on March 1st. Now, that motion to supplement seeks to add two things to the record. The first is a letter sent by the Deputy Attorney General to the judge, and the second is a letter sent by law professor Michael Milliman to the judge. Now, what's the nature of the dispute here? What happened basically was the Deputy Attorney General, both in his briefs and in arguments at the PCR proceeding, claimed that Milliman was one of the attorneys who represented Adnan before Gutierrez and sort of questioned why he, among others, might not have contacted Asia McClain. Basically, the Deputy Attorney General's letter to the judge is explaining to the judge how Milliman, in fact, only represented Adnan for the limited purpose of conflict of interest. And the letter from Milliman is saying it's a bit more complicated like that, and I want to make sure you understand exactly what's going on. One, before the Deputy AG mentioned my name at the hearing, he never contacted me to sort out my role. Two, he misrepresented my role materially at the PCR proceeding. Three, after learning of this, I reached out to the Deputy AG. I asked for a copy of the letter he'd be sending to you, and he failed to show it to me. And then four, I'm just setting the record straight. Here clearly was my role. Now, what's the importance of this? Well, nothing hugely significant in terms of the actual facts of the case of the law. My thinking, though, is, and I've written about this in my blog, is that it really calls into question the diligence by the state in this appeal. And my hope is that Judge Welch, in seeing that, will basically look over the entire state's case, its arguments, its factual claims with a fine-tooth comb. And I think what they'll find is, well, again, this in and of itself might not be that important. There are several other misrepresentations made by the state that do go to material issues on Brady as well as ineffective assistance.
There were a number of astonishing moments in the PCR hearing, and some of them we have yet to discuss, but I think it's fair to say one of the most shocking things that happened is what Prosecutor Theroux did with the security guard. He had detectives have this officer sign a document that he hadn't seen Adnan on January 13th, 1999. Now, it could be that he didn't quite know what Officer Steve had said and how it was conveyed, and maybe the detectives had a hand in this, but at the end of the day, he's the one responsible for the documents he is submitting to the court and to the judge. He introduced him as a witness, as if this poor man could actually remember with any credibility who he saw a day 17 years ago when it's like the first time he's being asked. But thankfully, on the stand, the officer was a straight shooter. He was an honest man. and he realized what happened, that he had been manipulated into signing something he didn't even stand by, which is ironically unlike Asia. It should trouble you deeply that the Deputy Attorney General of Maryland would ask for someone to make an affidavit containing statements that the affiant didn't actually agree with. To me, this means the truth is negligible to the state. And his sparring with Dave Irwin, well, it's more proof that instead of accepting with grace and humility that it is the duty of every attorney to contact any potential alibi before making a strategic decision, the prosecutor just wanted to play games. I mean, here's a question for you. Would you hire an attorney? Would you hire an attorney that told you that they wouldn't actually check all of your potential alibis if your case needed an alibi? Is that even acceptable to a layperson? Of course not. And it's not acceptable to any ethical, rational attorney worth their salt either. The fact that the state is arguing so hard for it to be acceptable is an embarrassment and it's unjust. But the embarrassment doesn't stop there. Because after the stellar testimony of their own witness, Officer Steve, that ended up favoring the defense, the state still had to tackle the cell phone fax cover sheet issue. Enter FBI agent and part-time cell expert Chad Fitzgerald. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.